I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. My guest for the first half of today's program, Governor Larry Hogan. His approval rating is among the highest for any governor in the country. With the 2018 Maryland General Assembly session close to the halfway point, the governor points to education funding and accountability, redistricting, and the environment as some of his top priorities. Mr. Hogan has distanced himself from Donald Trump and other national leaders of the Republican Party. In his State of the State address 2 weeks ago, he called for bipartisanship and cooperation. Democrats in the legislature say that Hogan's actions lead them to meet those calls with skepticism. Governor Larry Hogan joins me in Studio A, and after our conversation, we'll have analysis and reaction from Brian Sears, who covers Annapolis for the Daily Record. Midday starts right after the news. And good afternoon. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Hope you had a good weekend. My guest today is Governor Larry Hogan. He is one of the most popular governors in the United States. In a poll released last month by Gonzales Media and Research, 71% of Maryland voters said they approve of the job the governor is doing. He is one of only two Republicans elected to our state's highest office in the last 50 years. While there is no shortage of Democrats vying for the chance to face the governor in the general election in November, Mr. Hogan leads all of them in head-to-head matchups at this early stage in the campaign. We have the governor for the first half of today's program. He joins me here in Studio A. It's great to meet you. Thanks for coming.
Tom, thank you so much for having me today.
So first of all, how are you feeling?
I feel great. Yeah, I'm doing well.
You had a little scare with some skin cancer and stuff?
I did a week or two ago. I just had a few little things cut off my face, but I'm doing fine. They got all of it, and That's nothing like the bad cancer I had a couple of years ago, so it's nice and simple.
Yeah.
I got a couple of cool scars, but hopefully they'll fade eventually.
Oh, good. Well, we're glad to hear that. I'm going to start with education. You proposed last week a lockbox for funding generated from casino revenue. This is a proposal very similar to a couple of other proposals floating around Annapolis. Explain the gist behind yours.
Well, first of all, education has been and will continue to be our top priority has been for 4 years. We've had provided record funding for education, 4 budgets in a row. We just put together a $6.5 billion budget this year, which is far beyond what the legislative formulas would have called for and provides an increase for every single jurisdiction in the state. But this is a longer range and even bigger kind of proposal, and that is back in 2007, the legislature under the previous governor passed a bill. They had a campaign in 2008 called Slots for Tots, where they talked about they were going to provide all this casino revenue for schools, and it never really happened. It supplanted money that was in the budget, but it wasn't on top of. And that's been that way for 12 years. We and the legislature, we both agree that that money should be dedicated for schools. And the difference in our proposal, they want to put it on the ballot again. Voters already voted for it in 2008 and again in 2012. And so it's like, why? You know, we already know the voters want the money to go there. We can do it by statute. And so our legislation would take effect right away. It would put an extra $1 billion dedicated for school construction and $4.4 billion more for K through 12 education. And it would really, you know, solve some of the long range issues and problems. And I'm hoping that we can find bipartisan agreement. We're very, very similar on the legislation, and I think it's something we can all agree on.
Delegate Maggie McIntosh and Senator Joan Carter Conway have a bill to make it a constitutional amendment. Mm-hmm. They fear, frankly, it seems they fear what's been happening for the last 12 years, which is that the legislature will find ways of, subverting that money to some other place. Why not make it part of the Constitution so you know for sure that it's going to happen?
Yeah, I think you can require it by statute, as we have done on a couple of other things, but I'm not completely opposed to doing it that way. It just seems like it would take longer, and voters have already voted twice on the same issue. And the difference in our proposal is it actually tells you how you're going to spend some of the money, which theirs doesn't. But look, we've got we're about halfway through the legislative session. We're very anxious to sit down to talk with the leaders on both sides of the aisle and both houses to try to figure out what makes the most sense. But the good news is we all agree that education should be a priority and that we should provide more funding.
Any particular comment on Delegate Mary Washington's bill, HB 557? It will essentially do the same thing also by statute. I guess she's suggesting that her bill would have this stuff enacted a little quicker than yours. Is that a fair
assessment? No, I think Delegate Washington's bill is a good bill, and it would be just like ours. It would take effect immediately by statute rather than waiting for another election and another referendum and another vote by the voters. The difference being, we actually showed a commitment to putting $1 billion of that into school construction, which there's somewhat of a backlog on. That's the only real difference. But I think Delegate Washington has already talked about the possibility of amending her bill to maybe include our proposal.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, anytime you allocate a particular pool of money for a particular purpose, something gets bumped. Something gets left behind. The legislature has been using all this casino money for other purposes. Where do you find it?
Well, this is not an unusual circumstance, unfortunately. It had become the practice in state government to sort of rob, well, rob's probably a hard term, but to kind of take money from one trust fund or one specific pot of money and pour it into the general fund to spend on something else. This is one of them, but $1 billion was siphoned from the transportation trust fund and spent on completely unrelated things. So we had, in the words of Governor O'Malley, crumbling roads and bridges and the worst traffic in the nation because we didn't spend money on fixing and building transportation infrastructure. The previous administration also drained $2 billion from the Chesapeake Bay Trust, the Chesapeake Bay and Coastal Bays Restoration Fund, from Program Open Space. So there were billions of dollars moved around to try to, take care of a tough fiscal situation. We've worked hard to replace them all, and we fully we've restored all the funding to the Transportation Trust Fund. I'm the first governor in history to fully fund Program Open Space. We've funded the trusts. We put all the money back into the Chesapeake Bay Restoration Funds. And, now this is kind of the last one that hasn't been taken care of, this education lockbox, which they didn't have one. They just passed legislation and said, trust us. But I want to put it in statute and make sure that we can protect these funds like we have on all the other funds.
But what other programs do you speculate may be affected if this money is no longer available in the general fund?
Well, the good news is that, our revenues are up, and they're not as up as much as I'd like them to be. But, our economy, we went from, in 2013, just before I ran for governor, Maryland's overall economic performance was 49th out of 50 states. We're now up to number 7 in America. We've had, I think, the best economic turnaround in the country. We've gone from losing 100,000 jobs to adding 110,000 jobs. And we're starting, although it's slower than I would like, to see a turnaround. We had the best year for business in 15 years, the best year for job growth in a decade. And so I believe we're going to have growing revenues in the future. It would be even better if we could land 50,000 jobs from Amazon and a few other things we're working on. But we've been reinvesting all that money. We're doing the Purple Line and the transit systems and road projects and infrastructure, and all those are creating more jobs and opportunities. And so I think the growing economy and the growing revenues is going to help us pay for some of these additional things. And the casinos, which have now been expanded from when they were originally intended, they've got the new MGM casino, which is number one. They're bringing in more and more revenue. And so we have that money to put into the schools. And but it won't really come from – it's not going to, I don't think, hurt anything else.
The Kerwin Commission has hired a consultant to figure out what it would cost to really have quality education for every kid in the state of Maryland. And the number they come up with is huge. I mean, it's in the billions, $2.9 mm-hmm. billion, I think.
Right.
So even this casino revenue isn't going to approach that number. I mean, part of the issue isn't part of the issue here. Really, what should the funding formula be for schools? You are not known, for example, as being a guy who's particularly keen on mandated spending.
Right.
This would be another example of mandated spending.
Right. Well, part of the problem is there's so many everything can't be a priority. If everything's a priority, then nothing is. And so we keep mandating more and more things. For example, already we're only not quite halfway into the legislative session. They've only been in town for a few weeks, and they've already come up with $1 billion in new mandates. That takes away from things like education. 87% of our budget, the total amount of money we spend, is mandated increases in spending. And so we have about 13% of the budget that you can actually play with to try to balance things and keep the government running. But on education, so we our budget this year is $6.5 billion. We put the most money in, that's a record funding in the history of the state. On school construction, we have $385 million, which is the highest in a decade. But our new proposal would add $4.4 billion with the legislature. It's about twice what Kerwin calls for, or not quite. They used 2.9, we're at 4.4. It can be done. The Kerwin Commission, I think, you know, the well-intentioned, came up with some good ideas. The funding formulas do not work. They're dysfunctional.
Should they be?
Well, that's something for the whole discussion, looking at the Kerwin recommendations, getting all the experts. But I think most people realize that these were put in place in the past and everybody's struggling to try to deal with them. It, for example, required reductions, it proposed reductions in Baltimore City because it has a drastically declining population and a growing wealth, which is, you know, hard to imagine, but the numbers are actually going way up on incomes. And they're not getting the tax revenues because they've given away all the tax breaks to the people that are developing things in the city. So we ignored the formulas and gave big increases to Baltimore City anyway, but the formula would have called for big cuts.
But is there a framework that you support for a proper funding? I mean, there are an awful lot of people, first of all, a little upset that so far the Kerwin Commission, which has been deliberating for all this time, you referred to them as missing in action a couple of weeks ago. And this preliminary report that they issued once in January and again, they sent it out again a week ago, there's no mention of the funding formula. There are people on the commission who are saying, you know, hey, look, this has got to be our number one thing.
Well, look, Chancellor Kerwin is a friend. I think he's a smart guy. The members of the commission put a lot of time and effort, and I want to thank them for that. I haven't seen all their final recommendations, but they haven't issued a final report.
They don't have them yet.
So I can't say do I agree or disagree with them, but it is, you know, concerning that the legislature said we're going to put this commission together to give us recommendations to change, and then they said, I think they decided they didn't want to do it in this legislative session, or they're going to wait until after the election or something to that effect. It's very similar to a group called the Augustine Commission that they appointed 3 years ago to come up with recommendations on how could Maryland be more competitive and how could we grow our economy. And that they did the same thing. They failed to get the thing done in the session. The legislative leader said, oh, we don't want to hear those kind of recommendations, because I think they recommended tax incentives for businesses and things to grow. And they just tabled the whole thing. And I'm hoping that we can come up with some real ideas and move forward. We're going to continue to record fund education. We're going to continue to find ways to fund over the legislative formulas. I think, you know, every single child in Maryland deserves a world-class education, regardless of what neighborhood they happen to grow up in. And we can, you know, hopefully come together across the aisle and just figure out ways long-term to solve it. But, you know, right now we are some of the highest funded schools in the nation. I mean, it's Baltimore City is the fourth highest funded school system in America.
Speaking of Baltimore City, you've mentioned that some emergency funding that was necessary for a number of things. Maintenance, horrible problems they had with that in January when we had that terrible cold snap. There seems to be, from my vantage point, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, a sort of predilection or a premise of your understanding of how the city school system is running their railroad, that they are in need of much greater oversight. You call for an investigator general to oversee not just the city schools, but school systems throughout the city. Do you have, or throughout the state, do you have confidence that the Baltimore City school system is being run by reputable, credible people who are acting in the best interest of students?
Well, boy, that's a tough question. I mean, there are certainly reputable, well-meaning people who are running this, that are working and helping to run the school system. But there's also no question that there's wrongdoing and corruption and things that aren't running quite as well as they could be. Our concern, and I believe that Mayor Pugh shares the concern, it's not really just Baltimore City. Our proposal was we have a number of proposals to try to make, to put more accountability in education. Because, for example, in Baltimore City, the state pays for about 90% of the costs of the schools. And yet we have no control over a single penny that's spent. And there's been some.
So, you know, the people from the city say, you know, the state owns the schools. We have no control. So who's controlling the schools? For gosh sakes.
It really is the Baltimore City Board of Education, and the mayor can't control it, and the governor can't control it, city council, the legislature. And that's part of the problem. It's sort of like the people that are responsible to the taxpayers for the funding can't actually do the managing and running. And we don't want to be running the schools. We want local control over schools, but perhaps more authority to the city government, to the mayor. And so they're completely autonomous. And we just want more accountability statewide. And the state board has no ability to kind of oversee some of these issues. They're not equipped for it. We called for an IG, which actually a number of Democratic legislators have also called for, different pieces of legislation.
That's the Investigator General.
Investigator General. So that we've had multiple charges of fairly serious wrongdoing recently. You know, there was
at Prince George's County, at Baltimore County, there were questions raised. Certainly.
The Prince George's County, the unanimous delegation to Annapolis from Prince George's came to us and pleaded with us to get the state board to do an investigation on illegal, improper grade fixing. The State Board of Ed normally, you know, is not jumping in there unless something like that extraordinary happens. State Board of Ed, with an outside investigator, completed a study that showed 5,000 illegal grade changes. It was just ridiculous and horrible. In Baltimore County, we have questions of, you know, past the current and past superintendent that may have not listed, you know, money.
So you're not singling out the city.
Yeah, and the city.
On the other hand, though, there's this arcane, weird process for the city to be reimbursed for things, and they can't pay up front the way Baltimore County can, for example, or Howard County can. I mean, are you confident that that system, that process can be amended and fixed?
We'd like to fix that, but again, we still want the accountability. So if we put, as we do, billions of dollars into the city, we just don't want to write a blank check. You know, we'd like to fix issues about how maybe timing of funding, because they can't do things that everybody else in the state can do. But we don't want to just continue to exacerbate the problems. And so we put emergency funding in when they had the problems with not handling their heating and air conditioning systems. And we're also trying to fix the long-term strategy. But this is something that the state's been trying to, since I've been governor, we've been pushing to try to get those problems fixed. And they've been ignoring us. And then it came to a big crisis, which we had to step in and put even more money to try to fix.
On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. My guest today here on Midday, Governor Larry Hogan. Governor, let's move to the State of the State address that you gave a couple of weeks ago. You began and ended that address with comparisons to Washington and the dysfunction in Washington, saying that you wanted to make sure that the state legislature and you do not act in a way that the Congress and the Senate act with President Trump. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people blame the vitriolic tone in Washington on the top guy, on President Trump. Can you point to some examples where you are setting the tone for bipartisanship and cooperation between the two parties?
Sure. Well, you know, I actually began and ended my remarks at this what would be my final State of the State of my first term, quoting things that I said 3 years ago during my inaugural speech. I actually said those same things running for governor. So it goes back 4 years or more. And that was long before President Trump was elected. I was already frustrated with Washington and politics as usual and partisanship and just the kind of angry nature of the rhetoric on both sides of the aisle and the finger pointing and the name calling and nothing ever seeming to get done. And I railed against that. And when I ran for governor, I said I was fed up with politics as usual in Washington and in Annapolis. And in my inaugural address, I called, and in every state of the state, I believe, I've called on people on both sides of the aisle to put aside the politics and to try to come together to get things done for Maryland, that the problems we have in Maryland are not Republican problems or Democratic problems. And the only way we're going to solve some of them is by coming together with bipartisan common sense solutions. And I believe that that's what we have been doing. While there's obviously certain times when we're not going to agree, I've always strived for a compromise, and we have gotten a lot done. And, you know, I think that's why you started the show talking about, you know, there are more than 70% of the people in the state approve of the job that I'm doing, even though I happen to be a Republican in a state with 26% Republicans. So I think most people believe that I have acted completely different than anyone in the Trump administration or anyone in Congress, for that matter. We can disagree without being disagreeable, and let's find common ground. Mm-hmm. And it's working. And there are other people in the country doing the same thing. Charlie Baker, who's the governor of Massachusetts, a similar situation.
Yeah, highly Democratic state. And he's got even higher, a couple of points higher than you, which is pretty impressive. But are there things? I mean, it brings
Steve Bullock is a Democratic governor in a Republican state, does a great job too. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it brings to mind, what is the nature of being a Republican in this day and age? I mean, are there areas in which the national Republican leadership, McConnell, Ryan, and Mr. Trump, you know, resonate with you in terms of your personal values and your your governing philosophy? Are there parallels at all?
Well, look, my primary focus in running for governor and being governor has been, although we've done lots of other things, I've been focused on the economic issues, how to put more Marylanders to work, how to grow our economy. And we've been tremendously successful at that. Those are sort of, I guess, basic traditional Republican values. I have not gotten involved in partisan squabbles over social issues or certain things that maybe I don't agree with some members of my party. And I certainly do not agree at all with the tone and the, you know, I'm disgusted by some of the dialogue and some of the things that go on. And I'm mad at my party, but they don't have a monopoly on it. I mean, frankly, I watch television more often than I'd like. I see the national news and I see Republicans and Democrats who aren't getting anything done on the major problems, just talking at each other, and they never talk with each other. That's the problem.
Yeah, you don't need me to remind you that this is an election year.
Yeah,
and perhaps that's one of the things that's animating some comments that we've heard from Democrats, particularly in the last 10 days, 2 weeks, who complain that in a way you're sort of appropriating ideas that they've had. Like, for example, when you announced the lockbox about education, Delegate McIntosh, Senator Conway apparently weren't invited to that announcement. Delegate Washington wasn't invited. I mean, how do you respond to folks who say he's just grabbing Republican or Democratic ideas and Hoganizing them?
Well, you know, I love that, actually. I don't take it as a criticism at all. I kind of got a kick out of it. It's sort of like, we hate the fact that he's being bipartisan. I mean, why does he agree with us, you know, on Democratic ideas? Isn't that what I said I was going to do? When I disagree, I say I disagree. When I agree, I say I agree. And the fact that there are certain things that we all agree on, I think is a good thing. It is just politics, but it doesn't bother me. I mean, I don't care whose name is on a bill. I don't care who gets credit for it, if it's a good idea. And I said that in my inaugural address, and I said it again in my State of the State a couple of weeks ago. I don't care which side of the debate or which side of the aisle the solution comes from. If it's a good idea,
For example, with this lockbox, if for some reason your bill or Delegate Washington's bill doesn't prevail and the constitutional amendment bill does prevail, will you sign it?
We'll sign it and we'll support it and go campaign for it. I'd rather not have it delayed, and I'd rather not. I mean, then there's a chance it might get defeated. You know, that they run the risk of that. And the voter is saying, what the heck? Why are we voting for this a third time? Mm-hmm. But yeah, sure, we'll be out there and support it.
So I'll
campaign for it if it's on the ballot.
All right. As you mentioned, we're about halfway through. Halfway mark, I think, is Saturday or Sunday of this legislative session. So time flies when you're having fun. What are your priorities for the second half of the session? What would you like to see as a legislative legacy for this session?
Well, the good news is that we've made quite a bit of progress already, and we are going to find a lot of common ground, which is unusual. People thought in this last legislative session in the middle of a campaign year that we wouldn't get anything done, but I think we will. We're still focused on a number of things that they have not yet made a lot of progress on that we're pushing for. But, you know, we've got, our top issues are education, which we have a number of accountability measures. We're talking about the funding thing we just discussed, the environment, on crime. There's just any number on good government. We're still pushing hard for nonpartisan redistricting, which hasn't had a hearing, and it seems to be just in a drawer somewhere. It's something that an overwhelming majority of Marylanders on both sides of the aisle very strongly support, but we can't even get that.
And your idea is to have a separate commission decide the districts. The legislature thinks that's a good idea as long as four or five other states in the area agree to it as well so that Maryland doesn't single itself out.
Well, and the Baltimore Sun said that was a sham and that that was just to stop any real reform. But it's also where our bill affects legislative districts and congressional districts. I'm not sure why we have to wait for five states to tell us that we have the worst drawn districts in the nation and we should fix it.
Of course, there's the Supreme Court or the top court in Pennsylvania is going to be ruling today about that. So we'll keep a close eye on that. You did take the extraordinary step of signing an amicus brief yourself, and your attorney general is on the other side of that.
You know, it's interesting. You know, I happen to see this as another bipartisan issue. Look, there's neither party has clean hands on this. There are Republican states that gerrymander. There are Democrat states that gerrymander. But it seems like some folks only want to do it when it's the opposite party. I'm for cleaning up this stuff across the country because everybody's been guilty of it. But we are the worst in the nation.
And you're right. There's 70%+ support for an independent commission drawing the lines. Here in Baltimore, people are worried about state center. There's also 75% people polling say they support the plan as has been developed for state center. You oppose it. How come?
Well, first of all, I am 100% in favor of the redevelopment of State Center. It's been a top priority of mine since I was first elected. The mayor and I are working together to try to get this thing moving. We are very supportive of the community and what they want to get done there. But the issue is the previous administration signed a kind of an illegal and shady deal with a developer that was never going to happen. O'Malley tried to get it done at the end of his term and could not. It required capital leases to be signed by the state in perpetuity for something like three times the value of what the property was in order for them to finance it. There's a developer that had a development agreement but never got leases signed by the state.
But there's no way of, you know, amending that agreement. I mean, this thing has been 12 years in the making. The neighborhoods are for it. The plans are drawn.
So nothing happened during the entire 8 years of the O'Malley administration except for some attempts at doing things that were very improper. We started trying to clean it up from day one. We filed suit against the developer to get rid of them so we can finally move forward. That was after a unanimous vote of the Board of Public Works. So the false impression is that Governor Hogan doesn't like State Senator, doesn't want to move forward. The two Democrats, including one that represents the legislature, all voted unanimously against signing these leases because we were told it was illegal and improper. So we didn't. We voted against it. So it cannot move forward.
But the chances of something else moving forward?
So the mayor and I are anxious
to move. In our lifetime. You know?
We were supposed to have the previous failed developers who have done nothing for 10 years or so still have ongoing lawsuits that have been delayed and delayed.
Yeah, they're suing you for all the money they've invested over these years.
Well, they haven't invested hardly anything. They've done nothing.
They'll tell you it's millions of dollars.
Well, they haven't put a shovel in the ground, haven't got a single approval, haven't moved forward. They drew a couple of pictures. And we've, I think, sat down at the settlement table to propose offers to them. It's in the courts, and I'm very frustrated that if we can get rid of these guys, we'll start State Center the next day.
We just have you for a couple more minutes. And one of the other issues that is certainly very much on the minds of Baltimoreans and people in Central Maryland is violence reduction.
Yes.
There are folks who say that the legislative packages that you've proposed and the things that you've supported are kind of old school because they concentrate on, you know, mandatory minimums, what you refer to as truth in sentencing, and they're about they're about incarceration and punishment rather than prevention. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would say that's nonsense because last year, after an awful lot of work, I pushed through Justice Reinvestment Act, the first real criminal justice reform in our state in a generation, which provided for second chances, lower penalties, reduction of incarceration. We've reduced the size of our prison population by 1,000 people. We shut down the Baltimore City Jail. It provided all kinds of things along those lines. Our proposal this year, however, is only talking about the small number of repeat violent offenders. We have a situation in Baltimore City where people are, have an average of 11 arrests, 3 convictions on violent gun crimes in some cases, and they are continually let out on the street to shoot and kill people again. We've had over 340 murders. So while I am for lessening penalties and lessening incarceration and second chances and all those things, which we all passed all last year, we have a few pieces of legislation to make it tougher for people who commit a crime with a gun, because I think that's a special circumstance, and for people that repeatedly are convicted of violent felonies. So the two are not, you know, we can do both. We can find a way to reform criminal justice, give people more opportunities, put less people behind bars. But also there's a handful of folks that just really are bad people that we need to get off the streets of Baltimore because they keep shooting people.
Governor Larry Hogan has been my guest. Governor, I appreciate it, and you are welcome back anytime. Hope we can do this again sometime.
Thank you so much, Tom.
When we come back after a quick break, an update on the latest in Annapolis from Brian Sears of the Daily Record. And when we come back, we will try to get to some of your calls and comments. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, Erica Bridgeford. She's one of the founders of Baltimore Ceasefire. She's going to join me to talk about her activism and how her efforts are bearing fruit on the streets of our city. Plus, Deborah Bailey joins us for the Afro Check-In with the latest on the lawsuit between historically black colleges and universities and their primarily white institutional counterparts. We'll also speak to Dr. Earl Richardson. He's the former president of Morgan State University for his perspective on that case. That's coming up on Midday tomorrow. If you've just joined us today, we've spent the first part of the program with Governor Larry Hogan, who was not able to spend the entire hour with us. In the time we have remaining, reaction to what the governor said and a look ahead to what's in store as the General Assembly takes action on a number of bills. We'll hit the halfway point of the 2018 General Assembly session this weekend. You are welcome to join our conversation at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. Brian Sears covers the State House for the Daily Record, and he joins us now on the phone from Annapolis. Hey, Brian, how you doing?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Did you get a chance to hear what the governor had to say in the first half of the show?
I did.
And what did you think?
Well, I mean, a lot of it was very similar to things that we've heard down here in Annapolis, covering the legislature since we started, and even going back into December. So the governor has remained pretty consistent with his messaging.
And what do you make of the Democrats' contention that he has done an awful lot of sort of appropriation of bills that they have in fact championed? I guess it's Senator Lutke from Montgomery County tweeted last week, you know, when it comes to like the manufacturer's tax credit or the Hometown Heroes Act, or now this lockbox for education. These are all ideas championed by Democrats way in advance of what the governor when the governor jumps on board. What's the feeling among Democrats down there? Are they feeling like they're getting politically outmaneuvered by this guy who's, let's face it, a very popular public official?
I don't know whether I can speak to the fact that they feel like they're being politically outmaneuvered, but I definitely think that there are some Democrats down here who feel that the governor has liberally appropriated their ideas. And look, to be honest with you, it's, you know, all's fair in love and politics, and this has been something that has gone on with Democrats under Democratic governors for years, and a number of Republican legislators would tell you that they've had ideas that they've tried to get through the legislature for years, and then all of a sudden the lightning strikes and the time is right, and someone in Democratic leadership picks up their idea and it passes. So it's not uncommon.
We have a listener who sent us a tweet saying, calling out the governor, she says, or he says, that the governor is incorrect when it comes to the schools. It says that Mayor Pugh controls the Baltimore City School Board because of the appointments. That is true. The governor, or the mayor now does appoint the school board. But Mr. Hogan signed that into law in 2017. When it comes to the schools, there's an awful lot of people pointing fingers at other people back and forth between Annapolis and the city of Baltimore. What do you make of this? I mean, it does seem very murky and very unclear to people in the city and outside of the city who actually has the most influence and the most direct control of funding for the schools. Is that any closer to clarity?
It's not unfair to call this murky or cloudy, and some of it is fairly intentional. You have to remember how these systems are set up, and the school systems in Maryland are designed by nature to be outside of the sphere of political influence. It's meant to try and keep politics out of the school system. But part of that, is that in other situations where you have an agency that gets a budget and they're directly affected by the guy who writes the check. In this case, a lot of times you can't bring a school system to heel just because you're writing the check and because they're outside of political influence.
We have a phone call from Kevin in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Brian Sears of the Daily Record.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How you feeling?
I'm all right. Day off, school teacher, and you guys are talking about something near and dear. I've taught in Baltimore City, taught at City College, City Forever. And now I'm in the county. I've been there for over a decade, total of 20 years. And it feels like, to me, I come from Tennessee. I feel like I'm in a one-party state, one-party rule. I am a Democrat, but it just seems to me, having worked through the teachers' unions, that the Democratic Party here is failing the schools. They control mostly everything. I do wish there were other parties, Green or Republican, in Baltimore City. I wish there was better oversight of the schools. I did hear what the gentleman just said about, bringing schools to heel is very, very difficult. But the waste is awful in the school system.
And what could the governor or the state legislature or the mayor, for that matter, do about waste in the school system?
I wish I could tell you. I know that when we teachers try to call, go to the school board, it doesn't seem like there's much oversight. Perhaps if they're appointed, by the mayor, by the governor, that if they're appointees, then there should be better. They should be appointing better school board members. It seems like a broken system, and I don't know if it's a complete system overhaul. I don't know if it's something that has to be done in the state charter. I don't know.
Okay, well, thanks for the comment, Kevin. I appreciate it. Brian Sears joins us on the line from Annapolis. He covers the State House for the Daily Record. We'll have more reaction to the comments that Governor Larry Hogan made in the first part of today's show when we come back from a quick break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And before we take that break, on Mondays here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of the people who lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. 31 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence in the first 6 weeks of this year. Maurice Anthony Knight, age 34, was shot last June. He died in September, and last week the medical examiner ruled his death to be a homicide. Two other homicide victims died last week, Sadiq Griffin, age 22, and John Towns Jr. He was 56 years old. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, I spent the first part of today's show in conversation with Governor Larry Hogan. Brian Sears from the Daily Record joins me with his perspective on this year's General Assembly and the governor's plans for legislative accomplishments before the 2018 campaign begins in earnest after the session ends in April. The campaign for the Democratic nomination to face the governor in November is also heating up in the last few days. A number of Democratic candidates have announced their picks for lieutenant governor. Jim Shea, a lawyer with the high-powered Venable law firm, tapped Baltimore City Councilman Brandon Scott as his running mate. State Senator Richard Mottolano is expected to announce today that Luanda Jenkins will be on the ballot with him. She's a former aide to Governor Martin O'Malley. And former Obama administration State Department appointee Alec Ross is slated to announce today his choice of Julie Verratti. She's a businesswoman from Montgomery County. I'm told by a member of the Rushurn Baker campaign that Prince George's County executive will have an announcement about his choice at a press conference scheduled for tomorrow morning. Our conversations with the candidates here on Midday, it's a series that we'll do throughout the campaign, and it will kick off a week from Friday when Alec Ross joins me for the hour here in Studio A. He is the first of seven Democratic candidates who I'll talk to over the next few weeks and months. We'll also be introducing you to the candidates for Baltimore County Executive and other offices whose primaries take place on June 26. You can join our conversation then and now, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @midday_WYPR. Brian Sears from the Daily Record is here. Let's go to the phones. And Jocelyn in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm a teacher in Baltimore City, and I'm very concerned. I know the caller before said that he thinks that with a mayor and a governor-appointed school board, that would be better. But I'm actually more concerned about that because then they're only accountable to the mayor and the governor and not to parents, teachers, and students like I think they should be.
All right, so you're calling for elections for the Baltimore City School Board to have the citizens decide. All right, well, thanks for that call, Jocelyn. Brian Sears, any talk in Annapolis about making that the law of the land, or any talk even in the city? Have you heard anything one way or the other?
Not that I'm aware of, but I can tell you, Tom, that traditionally the conversation centered around elected school boards has been one that's been pretty difficult. Baltimore County just went through a fairly bruising 5 or 6 year debate over that, and came out of the other side with a hybrid elected school board system. It's probably not something that's going to get taken up this year, and even if it did come about in maybe next session, I wouldn't expect it to turn around on a dime.
On the environment, and that's one of the topics that we didn't get a chance to touch on with the governor, there was a protest around the governor's mansion last Thursday night where some folks in the environmental activism movement oppose the governor's apparent support of what people are calling the Potomac Pipeline. The governor, of course, supported the ban on fracking in Maryland 9 or 10 months ago. But now it appears that he and the Department of the Environment are not opposing this expansion of a pipeline that will come through Maryland and perhaps threaten the water supply in the Potomac River. So can you tell us a little bit about where that stands and what the feeling of the legislature is about that?
Yeah, what happened last week right after that protest is apparently the Department of the Environment released a letter that asked the Army Corps of Engineers to withhold a determination on the application until the state has an opportunity to propose special conditions for essentially what is going to be a roughly 3.5-4 miles of pipeline that'll cut through Maryland, connecting West Virginia to parts of Pennsylvania.
And so it's on hold now. I mean, is that going to be enough to appease the people who are flocking around the governor's mansion the other day?
Well, I think what's left to be determined is how Maryland reacts to it once, because remember they're asking the Army Corps of Engineers to delay a determination until they can weigh in. And so I think that opponents of this portion of the pipeline that cuts through Maryland are going to wait to see what Maryland says in their determination and what they send to the Army Corps of Engineers.
When it comes to tax reform, the federal tax bill that was passed by Congress in the Senate last December is going to have an impact on some people in Maryland, people who are used to itemizing their expenses. This won't go into effect this tax season, but next tax season it will. Do you think the governor and the legislature are close to a deal that would rectify that problem?
I don't think they're close to a deal, but that's not to give your listeners the idea that a deal won't get done. By everyone's best numbers here, it looks like about 350,000 Marylanders will directly be impacted by this and pay hundreds of millions of dollars in additional taxes because of the changes that will affect them. But by and large, most Marylanders will either pay, will do better than or not do worse than under this federal tax change. What the governor and the legislature definitely want to try to find a way to do is to hold people harmless for the additional tax revenue that would flow to Maryland as a result of this. There will be something that gets done. It's just at this point unclear whose plan is going to prevail.
It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest this afternoon, Brian Sears. He covers Maryland politics and governmental affairs for the Daily Record. Brian, we have another tweet that says, please ask the governor to go on the record with how much money he has received from the NRA. This came in after the governor was here. But do you have, obviously, people have very much front of mind this terrible massacre that took place in Parkland, Florida last week. Do you have any idea what the governor's relationship to the NRA is?
To be honest with you, I don't. I'd have to go look and see to be able to answer that question with any authority for you.
Yeah, me neither. I'm not aware that the governor is particularly popular with the NRA as a lobbying organization. When it comes to
Tom, there certainly have been some pro Second Amendment advocates who are not happy with the governor. They feel like he could move faster and move more decisively on things like concealed carry. So he's not exactly been a darling of the Second Amendment groups. And this is an issue that, if you remember going back to the 2014 campaign, he's really stayed away from issues like firearms and abortion and things like that. Saying that a lot of these issues in Maryland have been decided already.
Of course, the Democrats, all of whom are going to come on this show and do as many other shows as they'll be allowed to do, are going to very much make this campaign about Donald Trump as much as it is about Larry Hogan. He has been pretty deft and pretty adroit in distancing himself from the Trump administration and from Mr. Trump in particular. Do you think the Democrats' strategy of trying to link Mr. Hogan to Republicans writ large in this state is going to be effective? What's your take?
So there's two components of this, Tom. I mean, first of all, there's the idea that Trump is so unpopular that we're going to see a blue wave here in Maryland because of that. Voters are, we've already seen one poll, the Gonzalez poll, that came out and showed that sending a message, defeating Donald Trump, was the number one message that voters wanted to send in the 2018 election. But the flip side of that really is that, Hogan has been very disciplined when it comes to, distancing himself from, from the president. And right now, what we are seeing from every Democrat who's running is a steady stream of emails and press releases that either decry something that the president has done or, criticize the governor for not being fast enough on criticizing Donald Trump. And what we haven't seen Democrats do is distance themselves from each other and show what they stand for. And what we saw in 2014 with Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown was he tried very hard to demonize Larry Hogan, but he never gave voters a reason to vote for him. And I still think that that's a really important component in any campaign, is telling voters why you need to vote for them.
I agree. I mean, I think their efforts to demonize Larry Hogan were completely unsuccessful. I mean, then Lieutenant Governor Brown was trying to make Hogan seem like Darth Vader, and then people saw Larry Hogan and they say, this guy isn't scary at all. And here he is 3 years into his term and he's got a 71% approval rating. So it will be interesting. One of the things we just got to finish up here, we got about half a minute here. The governor has proposed what he calls the Transparency Act of 2018. This, again, has to do with the legislative process. He's proposed live streaming of the session in Annapolis, term limits, those kinds of things. Do you get any sense that there's any wave of support for those kinds of electoral ideas?
I get the sense that bill is just waiting for the coroner to come and declare it dead.
As undoubtedly it will, as and every year in Annapolis, there's a few bills, if not many more than a few, that are, in fact, declared DOA. Well, Brian, I appreciate the reporting that you do day to day, and appreciate your time this afternoon. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Sears covers governmental affairs for The Daily Record. He's joined us from Annapolis. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Erica Bridgeford, one of the founders of Baltimore Ceasefire, joins me here in Studio A. And we'll have one of our regular Afro check-ins with Baltimore Afro reporter Deborah Bailey and Dr. Earl Richardson. He's the former president of Morgan State. We're going to talk about the status of the lawsuit concerning historically black colleges and university. It's coming up tomorrow. On Midday, we want to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner, with breakfast served on the weekends. They're on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.